You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9:59 a.m. Next up, at 10 o'clock, we have American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.
So take heart and take care of your link with life. It's beautiful.
Hi, good morning. This is Jacqueline Keeler, your host for American Standoff. And we are a show that started at the beginning of this year, actually on January 6, 2022, a year after the storming of the Capitol. And we are looking at the standoff, the political standoff in America today. And I'm a native Dene and Dakota journalist based here in Portland, Oregon. And I do cover these issues on a national scale. So, we often start the show by looking back on January 6th and the specter of thousands of supporters of President Trump, gathered in D.C. and storming the Capitol to contest President Biden's election. And one of the things I will be looking at, particularly in the next episode, is the big lie, like how potent is that? How will that drive the midterm elections? And so we've seen these insurrections on our own streets, Proud Boys and with their marches and trying to come to Portland to basically start fights and to confront what they believe is a liberal city and bring the fight to our very streets. Also on December 21st, 2020, Oregonians saw our own state capitol in Salem breached by armed insurrectionists defying COVID restrictions. And they were actually admitted to the building by a former state representative, Mike Nierman. And today we're going to discuss a report from the state auditors issued by the Secretary of State's office that found that the breach of the state capitol capped a year of nationally significant domestic terrorism in Oregon. Actually, the report covers from 2011 to 2020. And so the report found that Oregon ranks 27th among states in population, but came in sixth among states from violent extremist attacks between those years of 2011 and 2020. And state auditors are citing data from the statistics from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in making these claims. In March, the report notes the Southern Poverty Law Center said that there were 10 active hate groups in Oregon, and extremist ideas were moving further into mainstream politics. So the auditor's report states that the threats have become, quote, increasingly complex and volatile, with people using social media and websites to propagate extremist narratives and activity. So as I mentioned before on the show, we examine the connections between seemingly disparate events like this and their origins in white supremacy and actually the DNA of colonialism. I do feel like these problems we're seeing are not simply individual problems, but they are actually structural problems based in the origin story of this country, which is a colony. I wouldn't say it's a country in the sense that you normally think of it being someone's homeland. These are the homelands of other people, of native nations that pre-exist and in many cases persist the occupation and of their land. And as I said before, I am Jacqueline Keeler, and I am your host. And so this is a call-in show, so please feel free to call in at 503-231-8187. And so that the breach of the Oregon Capitol, which, you know, we've been talking about, occurred in December 2020, and it resulted in an hours-long standoff of police. And according to this report, capped a year of heightened political-motivated violence. The report was issued by the state auditors for the Secretary of State's office. And we'll open the show with a short overview of the situation.
Strategic and International Studies, which actually tracks such things, Oregon is leading the way. That is a bad thing. The center found in 2021, 73 domestic terror plots or attacks across the country. 18 of those were in Oregon, the most anywhere, and most of those were around the Portland area. The next highest was New York with 7 plots or attacks. Against that grim backdrop, auditors with Oregon Secretary of State issued a report today saying the state needs to do more to protect itself against future domestic terrorism. Oregon has a long record of domestic terror or significant incidents. Some of the more recent history involves 1984. In the Dalles, where members of the Rajneesh movement contaminated salad bars of 10 restaurants as they tried to alter an election. 751 people got sick, 45 were hospitalized. In the 1990s, it was the Animal Liberation Front and the Earth Liberation Front, burning research facilities and toppling a BPA transmission power. In 2016, Ammon Bundy and his supporters took over the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in southeast Oregon and held it for 5 weeks. In September of 2020, a man on the far right supporting a pro-Trump rally in downtown Portland was shot and killed by a man on the far left, an Antifa supporter. In December that same year, far-right protesters entered Oregon's closed state capitol after a lawmaker let them in. There were many arrests along the way there, but no one in any of those incidents was charged with a state crime in Oregon for domestic terrorism. Why not? Because that crime does not exist here. It's something that state auditors highlighted today.
Despite Oregon's high risk profile in this area, we are one of only 16 states that do not have specific legislation criminalizing domestic terrorism and violent extremism. So that is a type of one of the recommendations we're intending for legislators to consider as they address this high risk area going forward.
Other findings from the audit included criticism of something called the Oregon Homeland Security Council, which sounds like a powerful group helping keep us safe, but the auditors found it has no statewide strategy with specific measurable outcomes for countering violent extremism risks and activities. Auditors also said police should get more training and agencies should define who will handle what when it comes to domestic terrorism.
So that was sort of some local news coverage, TV news coverage of this report that came out today, which we're discussing about the domestic extremism in Oregon. And I'd like to once again say good morning. This is American Standoff. We are a live talk radio show, so please do call in if you want to be part of this conversation. The number here is 503-231-8187. And my name is Jacqueline Keeler. I'm your host, and I'd like to greet you in Navajo in my own language as well. Yat-e, Mr. A, Jacqueline Keeler, Yunishkeh, and you know, in the Navajo way, you know, we introduce ourselves to our clans, and you know, I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation, but I am my clan in our traditional way is the way we really identify ourselves, and so so my clan is Kia'ani, Kia'ani Nishbeth. And I am born, in our terminology, we are matrilineal, so your clan comes from your mother, your identity. But your father's mother, you are born for her clan as well. And so my both of my dad's parents were Yank and Sioux, Dakota, so that is who I am born for. And my Che, my Navajo grandfather, his clan was Hushkaazo. And so, Yekasut. And so, but I'd also like to acknowledge that we, that this show is broadcast from Portland, Oregon, which is on the ancestral lands of the Multnomah, Wasco, Kaklamet, Clackamas, Kalis, bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kayapuya, Malala, and many other tribes. And so I am also a visitor here. These are not my tribes. And, so a year ago on January 6th, you know, once again, we all saw the storming of the Capitol and the show, American Standoff, is a place where we discuss what we have learned in the year, going on a year and a quarter since. And today we are discussing the State Auditor's Report on Domestic Extremism in Oregon, which described the December 2020 breach of the Oregon Capitol and the standoff with the police that happened afterward as capping a period of heightened politically motivated violence in Oregon. The report covers the years between 2011 and 2020. The auditors assert that by improving coordination between different levels of government, as we heard in the report, and agencies grappling with the threat of extremist acts, the state could do more to prevent these events from happening. We'll also discuss the recommendations about policing and this law, which I think has issues with it, problematic. And The report notes that Oregon ranks 27th among states in population, but came in 6th among states for violent extremist attacks between 2011 and 2020. So we, you know, from 27th to 6th, we are, for our population, we are very, the state has a very active sort of group that's working, is creating these violent extremist attacks. And so, and they're citing data from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The Southern Cal Poverty Center, as I mentioned earlier, said there were 10 active hate groups in Oregon, and these extremist ideas are moving more into mainstream politics. And in my book Standoff, I did go and look at a number of these groups, and there are many of them have ties to Idaho and you know, northeastern Washington state, and particularly the 3%ers, the militia groups. According to the auditors' report, the threats have become increasingly complex and volatile, with people using social media and websites to propagate extremist narratives and activity. And certainly we've seen that with the rise of QAnon and the inability to stop the difficulty in really stopping the radicalization of people to believe complete fabricated stories. And so Oregon state law doesn't define, the report makes this an issue, or criminalize violence, domestic extremism. Do you think that, my question to my audience is, do you think that that they should? And what exactly this would do? Would it actually work? Auditors have suggested Oregon consider looking to other states that define violent domestic extremism or terrorist acts in their laws, which means the state can charge offenders if federal standards aren't met. And I think they mentioned that we're one of only 16 states that don't have such a law. However, I know that in states like South Dakota, which I have covered because I cover a lot of issues for different my dad's tribe and other tribes there in South Dakota, you know, that can often be abused. I know that because of the success of the pipeline protests, South Dakota Republican Governor Kirstie Noem has actually, and the state legislature there in South Dakota, which is very Republican, has actually passed laws like making it a crime for like just a group of people to meet. And these echo of old laws that were on the books that made it a crime for American Indians to meet in groups larger than five. And so there is a way in which these laws can definitely being used to silence dissent that is unwanted, you know, particularly coming from indigenous nations, native people, or in the case of the use of violent force on Black Lives Matter protests. Federal law defines domestic terrorism as acts dangerous to human life that are illegal, primarily taking place on U.S. soil, and appear to intend to influence a government or intimidate people. The attacks on the quote from the report and the U.S. Capitol over the last couple of years clearly, actually this is from the Audit Division Director Kip Mehmet, who helped author the report, who says that attacks on the Oregon State Capitol and the U.S. Capitol over the last couple of years clearly demonstrated the risk to public safety and the high cost on public resources resulting from domestic terrorism and violent extremism. Our report notes that Oregon is especially at high risk for this type of violence. And these things can be very expensive. We did an episode about the Canadian truckers, right? And apparently their stunt there in Ottawa cost around $35 million. And so quite expensive. The report also suggested the state's Homeland Security Council. I don't know how many of our audience are familiar with that council or what it's about. I would love to learn more about it. Develop a statewide strategy that provides, quote, specific measurable outcomes to counter extremist activities. And the state, they also suggest that the state revises its plan to protect critical infrastructure like hospitals and power plants with the latest information on threats of violent domestic extremism. So once again, today we are discussing the recently released state auditor's report on domestic extremism in Oregon. Please call in to be part of this conversation. Our studio number is 503-231-8187. And this is American Standoff, and I'm Jacqueline Keeler, your host. In my book, Standoff, which came out last year, I examine the response to the takeover and armed occupation of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge here in Oregon, which I covered as a journalist for Indian Country Day and other publications, and contrasted it to the response to, to the nonviolent Lakota encampment called Ocheti Shakoin, which was in response to a protest to try to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock, which is what I ended December 2016 covering that that protest. And so you may not know it, but the former United States Attorney for the District of Oregon, Billy J. Williams, is also Native American. It isn't brought up very often, but as the federal prosecutor in Oregon at the time of the Bundy takeover of Malheur, Williams failed to bring the Bundys to justice. And I do review that a bit in the book, that case. The Bundy crew got their acquittals, and they love juries. They love all these ideas they have about old English common law, and with a jury of their peers, they were very persuasive, right? In a way that juries are not so willing to lend an ear to the concerns of brown, black, indigenous, and people of color in this country. So some criticized his decision to prosecute on these very broad charges. He was using an old law from the Depression people were attacking because of the difficulties in the Depression. There was some attacks on different officials, and so they outlawed this. But you have to prove intent with this law. So you actually have to prove that they had the intent of basically doing this, and intent was very hard to prove with the sort of strange mind-melding, world-bending or world-building sort of mentality of Ammon Bundy and what exactly their intent was. And so it was not an easy, it was just not easy to actually prosecute or to bring any sort of charge, really a successful case to that. And so it was very difficult to convict, basically. They could have actually used much more simple charges, such as use of a stolen federal vehicle, just one of many examples, and that would have been much easier to win. And we could, and their Bundys and their followers may actually have served time in prison besides. So this is I think this is an oversight. Williams went for charges that put the responsibility on the prosecution to prove intent and ended up with them all walking. So if you were curious, here's what Williams had to say on this recent report.
This is Billy J. Williams. He's the former United States Attorney for the District of Oregon who served under both President Obama and President Trump. He's now in private practice in Central Oregon and talked about domestic terror with me today.
There's a lot of activity on the internet that is of concern, but you know, you always keep in mind, people have First Amendment rights to believe in whatever ideology they want to believe in, whether it's a failed ideology like white supremacy or an ideology like that motivates people to be part of the Antifa movement.
He said it's only a problem when they do things that violate the law. He was in office during the takeover of the Malheur Refuge and personally was down there overseeing the federal response. He said the lack of a federal domestic terrorism law is a big problem.
What's missing is a tool, if you will, in the prosecutor's toolbox to bring, where appropriate, federal domestic terrorism prosecutions. That's missing. There's been a lot of discussion about what that would look like, how it would be defined, but that's up to Congress to take that up.
And is that why somebody like Ammon Bundy faced relatively minor charges?
Yeah, there were only so many tools in the toolbox for both the state and us on the federal side of the house.
Okay, so that was the interview with former federal prosecutor for Oregon, Billy J. Williams, and you know, he seems to be pushing for this law. I would love to hear folks' response to listeners' response to this, what Billy J. Williams is pushing. And you can call in here to the studio at 503-231-8187. Do you think that more laws on domestic extremism should be passed? And how do you feel they will actually be implemented? That's the question. You know, expansion of police oversight is troubling. Last year, The Guardian, a British newspaper, compared the percentage of all demonstrations organized by left-wing and right-wing groups in the United States that resulted in the use of forces of law by law enforcement. They found that for left-wing demonstrations, about 4.7%. 4.7% of protests did face, the use of force by law enforcement, while with right-wing demonstrations, only about 1.4% were faced with a violent use of force, meaning law enforcement was three times more likely to use force against left-wing versus right-wing protests, right? And from the article, It also used statistics from the U.S. Crisis Monitor. It's a database created in spring 2020 by researchers at Princeton and the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, called the ACLED, which is a nonprofit that has previously monitored a civil unrest in the Middle East, Europe, and Latin America. And the article says the disparity in police response only grew when comparing peaceful left-wing versus right-wing protests. Looking at the subset of protests in which demonstrators did not engage in any violence, vandalism, or looting, law enforcement officers were about 3.5 times more likely to use force against left-wing protests than right-wing protests, with about 1.8% of peaceful left-wing protests and only half of a percent of peaceful right-wing protests met with tear gas, rubber bullets, or other force from law enforcement. So 3.5 times more likely. The percentages in this study were 1.8% for peaceful left-wing protests and only half of a percent for peaceful right-wing protests. That is quite a difference there. Police are not just engaging more, because left-wing protesters are more violent. They're engaging more even with peaceful protesters. Dr. Rudaba Kishi, ACLED's Director of Research and Innovation, told The Guardian. That's the clear trend. So ACLED's data also shows that the U.S. law enforcement agencies were more likely to intervene in left-wing versus right-wing protests in general, and more likely to use force when they intervened. American law enforcement agencies made arrests or other interventions in 9% of the 10,863 Black Lives Matter and other left-wing protests between April 1st, 2020 and January 8th, 2021, compared with only 4% of the 2,295 right-wing protests. So 9% for Black Lives Matter and other left-wing protests, and 4% for right-wing protests. So half of the time police made any intervention into a left-wing protest, it involved using violent force, ACLED found, compared with only about a third of the time for right-wing protests. So that is pretty concerning, and that is part of the sort of the framing of these laws, like how will they actually be implemented? And even in a state that isn't as overtly racist as South Dakota, per se, let's say South Dakota is known as the Mississippi of the North for American Indian people. You know, here in Oregon, I think statistically those sorts of numbers still hold. There is, in a white supremacist society, there is a general sort of, I think, tendency to support, to view any sort of questioning of the system as a threat, as an existential threat. And so once again, this is Jacqueline Keeler, and this is American Standoff, and I'd like to encourage you to call in to the studio if you want to be part of this conversation. The number here is 503-231-8187. And if you are just tuning in, today we are discussing a recent state auditor's report issued by the Secretary of State's office that found Oregon has some of the highest rates of domestic extremism in the United States. However, what is fomenting so much of this violence, right? I don't, a lot of it, you know, as you may know, has to do with the big lie. And a year ago, shortly after the Capitol insurrection, polls showed many Republican voters embraced anti-election conspiracy theories, believing Donald Trump's big lie, which is it questions the legitimacy of Joe Biden's presidency. They actually think that Donald Trump is still the president, right? And a year later, in 2022, polling indicates that very little has changed on that. A USA Today Suffolk University poll found that a majority of GOP voters continue to believe Biden wasn't legitimately elected to the White House, right? In contrast, an even more significant majority of Republican voters believe that, get this, they believe that the January 6th rioters went, quote, too far, but they had a point, right? That is very striking there. It seems like what has happened in the year since the Capitol insurrection, where armed right-wing protesters claiming that Donald Trump was still president, instead of rejecting this, what seems the majority of Republican voters believe that they had a point, that maybe they went too far, but they had a point, right? That is really concerning and really dangerous to civil society, right? To the conduct of civil society. And I think you see this as well in this sort of authoritarian tendency, where you see these same folks who are Trump supporters and Trump himself recently still, you know, really sort of loving Putin. And I don't know, it's pretty strange. For the correlation between authoritarianism and white supremacy in this country, I think it is strong. I think there is an element to that. That is, they like the strong man, which is why they vote for Trump, right? They like the sort of disregard for equitable civil rights, for the conduct of a system that will actually allow equal representation for everyone. They refuse to acknowledge that it's a problem. And they refuse to follow follow the rule of law, right? So NPR also found in a national NPR Ipsos survey that two-thirds of GOP respondents agree with the verifiably false claim that, quote, voter fraud helped Joe Biden win the 2020 election. Two-thirds. That's two in three Republican voters, right? They believe that Joe Biden won the election due to voter fraud. There is no, there's nothing to support that. And that is very concerning. Two-thirds of GOP respondents, right? A vital pillar of the big lie that was that the election was stolen from former President Donald Trump, right? And so fewer than half of Republicans say they are willing to accept the results of the 2020 election. Fewer than half of Republicans today in 2022 say they are willing to accept the results of the election, right? A number that has remained virtually unchanged since we asked the same question last January. That's NPR saying that. So NPR's report also found support, quote, support for false claims about election fraud and the January 6th attack have been remarkably stable over time. So, you know, they saw what we saw, right? But they are fine with it. They think that it was warranted, right? So how would this feed into future domestic terrorism here in Oregon? That's my question. And to what extent would a law like this really be focused on that, right? That if you want to call in and give me your opinion on that, please do. You can call into the studio here at 503-231-8187. And but another question I have is, what do the Republican candidates for governor in Oregon think? Do they believe the big lie? So let's listen to some audio of them answering the question.
Talking about all this, let's not forget the takeover of the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th of 2020. It was a mob supporting President Trump who took it over. Many were there motivated by the lie the former president is still pushing that the election was stolen from him. It's not true, but some still believe it. Which brings us to Oregon Republican candidates for governor. We're asking them that simple question. Did President Trump have the last election stolen from him? Again, the factual answer is no, but it is tricky for some who don't want to turn off the hardcore Republican base here in Oregon, which clings to that false belief. And some cling to that belief themselves. Bob Tiernan is up first.
Do I think President Trump lost the election? Yeah, I think he lost the election. And I think it was a combination of reasons. And I have no doubt there was fraud. I have no doubt there was some bureaucratic bumbling. I had no doubt with over 3,000 counties counting ballots and you know, some dead people probably voting. But do I think it was enough to overturn the election? I don't.
Next, let's hear from Bridget Barton, who I think is trying to live in the middle on this question.
I don't know. And neither do you. And neither does anyone out there. And that is why we're in the state that we're in right now in this country, where people are just at each other's throats. We are in a situation where people literally don't know the answer to that. And that can't continue. How is any voter supposed to know? How would you know? Can you categorically say you know?
Have you heard of the Electoral College?
I know what the vote count was going through. I'm not denying what the vote count is, and I'm not denying who's sitting in the Oval Office. And that's the way it is, and that's the way it's going to be.
Okay, there was a bit more there. I thought there was a third person that they were going to interview. I guess I got cut off, so... Yeah, they also interviewed some of the different candidates. I know that we've discussed on this show before, folks have called in and expressed concern about some of these candidates that are running for office here in Oregon. And so far in Oregon, we have, because Oregon Governor Kate Brown has been term limited and can't run for re-election, we now have 40 candidates as of March 24th, they have run for the governor's position. And 35 are running as Democrats and Republicans. The primary election is going to take place in May, May of this year, May 17th. And so you heard Stan, well, actually the one that was not, was not actually didn't got cut off there was Stan Pulliam, and he had some pretty crazy things to say. We have a caller, Dr. Freddie.
Hi, thank you for having me on the phone today. My comment has to do with January 6th, the Capitol. I'm a sociologist and a historian. I've never seen anything like that ever happen, and I'm glad some people are going to jail and some people are paying for what they did. But then again, some people think they have a right to do whatever they want to do, and I'm saying, as a person of color, that if that had been black at that Capitol, the blood would still be running down the main avenue, and that's my comment. Racism is alive and well in Oregon especially, so we need to really think about that. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Thank you, Dr. Freddie. Yeah, I totally agree. It's when I was interviewing, when I started interviewing the Burns Paiute Tribal Council about the takeover of Malheur, that was the very first thing they said to me. I interviewed them as the entire council together, and they also said that at their press conference that they had, that if they had done this, if they had taken over the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, which actually was once part of their reservation. There was the Malheur Indian Reservation, which encompassed 1.8 million acres, pretty much all of Kearney County, and that was that they lost because they were implicated in the Shoshone, the Bannock Wars, and they lost their land. And they were actually forced, I mentioned this before in this show, but for those who haven't heard, they were forced marched, the entire tribe, some of them chained together, their legs shackled together, all the way up to Yakima, Washington, in the middle of winter with a foot of snow on the ground. And they said that that's what they told me, was that if they had done that, they had to come back and actually live in the dump, the town dump. They were landless. They returned. They came on their own, swimming across the river, that kind of stuff, the Columbia River, coming home. And they have since managed to regain some of their land in the county. And they said if they had done that, they would have been shot. They knew they would have been shot. There's no way they could have occupied the wildlife refuge, even though that is their homeland. And when I spoke to them at the time, originally, the governor Kate Brown had not even included them in the conversations around the occupation of their homeland, and it wasn't actually until I asked her in person. I asked her if she had spoken to them, and she actually falsely claimed she had to me that she actually finally called them and started bringing them into the conversation. Which, under federal law, as a federally recognized tribe, they should have been at the table from the very beginning, and they were not, even after they gave the press conference. So, but this sort of ignoring of Native sovereignty, which we brought up in the last episode. Last week I had a conference I had to give a presentation at, but the week before that I looked at particularly the whole issue of the rural vote, the rural white vote, which is incredibly Republican, incredibly that supports, is part of this, you know, majority of the Republican Party that supported the January 6th insurrection, that has felt they were just a little too violent, but they thought they had a point, right? It's just incredible. I mean, but those people are occupying vast areas of land that's our land, right? They're not there by mistake or by happenstance or just whatever. This was a policy to take our land and hand it over to white people, right? You know, the Homestead Act here in Oregon, we have the Donation Land Act, which was actually a sort of a model for how land was given away in this country to white people primarily. And so it's no accident that these vast areas of our country are white and Republican and reactionary, right? And the Bundys themselves build a lot of their narrative around the idea that they are the landowners. They are the ones who own the land. They deny that the United States government even owns land, right? They are the landowners. They get to decide what's done with the land. They know best, right? And it's this sort of arrogance that feeds a lot of the way they're going about discussing these policies and discussing what direction we're going to take in this country, and turning to violence to do it. And they have always used violence. This is an American tradition, the use of terrorism, domestic terrorism. That's what the lynchings were about. You know, not to trigger anyone whose family were subjected to those, obviously. I apologize for that. But I think that we should also celebrate, but also it's very strange that it took 100 years to get a lynching law passed in this country. It was just passed this past week, you know, by Congress. This was after 200 attempts to get the law passed. It was introduced into Congress 200 times, and only passed this past week. And I would credit Black Lives Matter for that, for finally getting that. And also, you know, it probably would not have passed still if the Republicans had a majority, which they may have by the midterm, right? And so we are at a crossroads of asserting what kind of country we're going to be, and how are we going to be a country, right? If we are a country at all. Like, I assert that this is a colonial occupation, basically a militarized colonial occupation held through domestic terrorism, right? And so how can a law that challenges domestic terrorism by a colonial government, you know, a law issued by a colonial government, whether it's the feds or the state, you know, the state of Oregon would not exist without the without taking the lands from the tribes here in Oregon, right? And it wouldn't exist. It couldn't exist even under the rules of adding states that the U.S. government devised when they annexed the Northwest Territories around the Great Lakes in Ohio. And you know, you have to have so many white men here. You know, you have to have so many white men, you know, who are going to, you know, convene the government of the territory, and all these things that involve white supremacy, that involve terrorism, that involve violence. The land was not taken peacefully. The land was taken through violence, not only through to our warriors, but to our entire families. I mean, everyone who was forced marched from Burns, from the Burns Paiute tribal members who were forced marched to Wapato on the Yakima Reservation. You know, those were children too. I mean, we look at with horror at what's going on in Ukraine and other countries like, you know, Syria, where children, and Palestine, where children are being killed in violent ways, you know, by a state. And but that happened here too. You know, that is how this country came to be. It was absolutely a strategy of war, of terror. You know, and you know, my own family, you know, that happened to us. My father's people, you know, in the Dakota Territory, what is called the Dakota Territories, our homelands, you know, children were victims, right? And elders, as well as fighting age adults, you know. And in my own family, you know, my two of my my great-great-grandmother was forced marched as a child into a concentration camp that Navajos were put into, the Diné people, and by the U.S. government, and thousands died in this concentration camp, and they were finally freed. She actually came of age in this concentration camp, my direct grandmother. And so, you know, why it's amazing I'm even here. I mean, she easily could have died there. I wouldn't be here if she had died there, right? And so in so many cases, you know, it's a, you know, how can people not look at the structure and history of the United States and see why domestic extremism exists, why the state tends to focus on, you know, that you know, done for protests, done for liberal reasons, whether it's preserving the land, the resources, the trees, or people of color, right? So
So we have another caller, Rose.
Yes, thank you for bringing up the indigenous perspective. I have a couple of comments about what happened at Mulyere. I thought it was shameful that the federal government nor the Oregon government dealt with the native people, because that's their land, and those people were occupying their land, first of all. Second of all, about a law, since the military and the police force in this country was founded by the people who founded the slave patrols and the vigilantes that went after native people and destroyed them and burned their villages, etc. And since this country, its foundational principle is white supremacy and white nationalism, I think it would be very problematic about having a law, because, of course, who would enforce it? And then I wanted to make the audience aware, I don't know if you know about this controversial Reawaken America tour rally to be held at Kaiser Volcano Stadium in Salem, April the 1st and April the 2nd. And it's brought to you by those same people that brought you the story about the big lie. The event, it says in this Statesman Journal article, says, at other locations has focused on support for former President Donald Trump, as well as false allegations surrounding the presidential election and COVID-19. Speakers advertised at the event include Michael Flynn, Roger Stone, Mike Lindell, etc., and their ilk. And they will be in Salem tomorrow, April the 1st, and Saturday, April the 2nd. So perhaps some Republican gubernatorial candidates will weigh in at that rally, and those are all the comments I have, and thank you so much for bringing us the indigenous perspective. Goodbye.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you. Wow, I had not heard of that rally, and it's pretty shocking, actually. I had not heard. I'm looking at it right now. I know that I want to make sure I got the name of the rally correct. Is it Make America True Rally in Salem, actually starting on April 1st? And I would love to learn more about that. I think I might want to go and listen to some of the speeches and record them. And although being the only brown person in the crowd, I might be feel a little out of place, and they might target me as a journalist. But yeah, I would. You heard the difference. The three Republican governors that were interviewed about whether they believe the big lie, right? And actually only two of them were Sam Pulliam was a total believer. He's pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, all pro-property rights, of course, you know, and he's the current mayor of Sandy, Oregon. And I understand he's gotten some I guess it came out that he is a former swinger and a current big lie creep. The Wonkette headline says, Oregon GOP governor candidate admits he's former swinger and current big lie creep. So, yeah, so he will probably definitely be there. And then it seems like often you rarely hear Republicans willing to strongly speak out against these things, because they're hedging their bets. Because they know if 80% of Republicans believe the big lie, they don't gain any sort of even here in Oregon, I'm sure the percentage of Oregonians Republican Oregonians who believe the big lie is that high, right? How can an Oregon candidate, Republican candidate, win for governor, even a primary, if they don't support these ideas that the most Republicans in Oregon hold, right? Even if they are false. So the lack of courage by mainstream Republicans to challenge the big lie, and also the continued Trump is still the de facto leader and kingmaker of the Republican Party in this country, and he's able to yank support for candidates. If they don't follow the line he wants, whatever temperamental issue he has with them, that means a large section of the electorate is still under the sway of his personality and his ideas, even though they are false ideas. And so I imagine that rally in Salem on April 1st, the Make America True rally, I think. I couldn't find anything on it, but if anyone else has any information, please let me know. And you will see a lot of these candidates as they get closer to the election really begin to equivocate. I suspect that a Republican candidate cannot win a primary without this. And certainly we've seen even really extreme conservative Republican senators like Liz Cheney, right? Or Congresswoman, sorry, Liz Cheney from Wyoming, the daughter of the notorious war criminal, former Vice President Dick Cheney, right? Her even sitting on the January 6th committee has lost her all her committee assignments in the Republican Party, and now she has she will definitely run in the primary against a whole contingent of far right, even denier, big lie believer candidates, and she probably will not be in office anymore, right? This is what we've been seeing, and so how to bring this back to the issue of Oregon's very high rate of domestic extremism events in the country. I think we're first, and then New York State is second, right? And a lot of this is coming from, we did a show a couple weeks ago about Greater Oregon, or Greater Idaho, right? Greater Idaho, which is this notion that that these eastern counties in Oregon and Washington State and Northern California all want to join Idaho and form this sort of big Republican state, right? Composed of a lot of land that is not occupied by a lot of people, but is native land. And I did raise the question then, like, what native nations whose homelands those are have to say when suddenly the colonial government's going to change to the Idaho, one that is even more resistant and refuses to listen to native concerns. And so much of the funding still goes through the states, even for tribes, right? And they have to go to the state hat in hand and fight for their part of the funding that was agreed to them. Sometimes even funding agreed under treaty, right? Which is, should not be the case. States should not have a role. When we're looking at domestic extremism, simply, outlawing it in a state that in a white supremacist state that tends to use those laws, against social justice protests versus white supremacist protests, what it misses is the actual drivers. What is driving this, right? I think that is what actually needs to be addressed. What is driving this? And I think that it does require, and one of the things I bring up in my lecture about how the United States is still a colony, right, is that the only way that you can make changes is through the structural components that generate it. So why do so many Republicans, and the Republican Party is largely composed of white Americans, why do so many white Americans, human beings who identify as white and who are identified by the large society as white, why do so many of them share these ideas like the big lie? What is it about the history and the forces of American society that make this so? And that, I think, is the question we need to be asking, right? Because that is what actually needs to change. And certainly the work of the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Lives Matter movement have had an incredible impact on that for many people, for many Americans, but not all, obviously. The force and the structure of white supremacy, the DNA, that origin story, as I call it, is still incredibly potent. I think after the 1960s and 70s, there was a feeling that somehow this would just go away, that somehow, you know, when those old racists from the 1950s who were, you know, viciously hitting on a child for going to their school, when they died off, that somehow it would just dissipate, right? All of this racism. But it doesn't, you know? I mean, and so that, therefore, it is not an individual problem. It is not a problem of a certain time period. It is a structural problem endemic to the very creation of this country, right, of the concept of America and other colonial states. And I'm working on a story right now for a Canadian magazine about the residential schools there. We call them boarding schools here in the United States, where the Canadian government, working with churches, abused and harmed Native children, right? And they're digging up their graveyards now in unmarked graves where some of the children were buried. I'm doing a story right now about the Mohawk Institute where some of my husband's family went. He's from the Six Nations Reserve in Canada. And it's just been very emotionally traumatic to go through those stories. And it's just been very hard. But you know, I was looking at a YouTube video that was covering local CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Company, that was doing a report on a number of the Indigenous First Nations, Métis, and Inuit delegations have gone to Rome to meet with the Pope, to the Vatican, and they've been meeting with him. I think the two of the Métis and First Nation, or Métis and Inuit, met with him already, and today the First Nations delegation is meeting with him. And they want an apology, right? They want an apology because 80% of the residential schools in Canada were run by the Catholic Church. And I was looking at the comments on the YouTube video. I mean, never read the comments, right? But I did. And it's all these people, these white Canadians, just sneering at the problem, you know, and just saying, well, why don't they just go fix their bigger problems, you know, drunkenness and all this stuff. And it's like, well, why do we have those problems? You know, what are the causes of those problems? And being molested as a child, being told you are dirty and unworthy, you know, being separated and never hugged. I mean, that was just really painful to think that members of my mother-in-law's family went to these schools and they spent 10 years of their lives there never being hugged by an adult, never being told a positive thing about themselves, right? Just being told that they were dirty, and this is the violence of a white supremacist system, and it's the violence that we don't honestly contend with, right? And we need to. So that is, I mean, it seems a big jump to go from residential schools in Canada to, you know, a domestic terrorism law here in Oregon, but because they are all addressing the same issue, right? How do we address inequality? How do we address the legacy and history of violent colonialism, right? Because these are all the result of a colonial experience and an occupation, a military occupation that was waged to take them out, and then this drive, this economic drive, right, to profiteer off of the whole thing, you know, which then led to, you know, the stealing of free people from Africa to hold them in bondage for generations and take everything that they had in their lives, right, to make a buck for them to be able to wear fancy dresses and you know, live in plantation houses. I mean, those are basically like Auschwitz. They're just horror houses, right? And this is that house, that plantation house, that is America, right? That is every colonial entity. And so how do we deal with domestic extremism in Oregon? You know, first of all, we don't equivocate. We can't say that left and right wing things are the same because they're fighting for different things. I think that kind of reporting is irresponsible and is very white, you know, white centered, you know, and you know, they're fighting for different things. Fighting for social justice is very different than fighting for a white supremacist system that basically you know, creates a class of people whose lives are disposable and are and causes tremendous harm, right? So different things. And so I hope that think I'm almost at the end of the hour here. I'd like to thank my callers and this is Jacqueline Keeler, and this is American Standoff, and I do this show in the hopes that someday we won't have an American Standoff anymore. My next show will be looking a much deeper dive into the big lie. The claim that Donald Trump is still our president, right? That insane idea. And maybe a little bit at how these factors play out in other ways. But I'd like to thank you all for listening, and I will be back next week. Hagoshi.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 11 a.m.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This is Cesar Chavez. You're listening to KBOO, listener-sponsored radio.
Today on Peace Talks Radio, the nonviolent path of Cesar Chavez.
Farm workers in Delano, California, have begun an unprecedented strike in the Central Valley.
A conversational profile of the late Cesar Chavez, co-founder of the United Farm Workers.